All right. Well, I do want to welcome you all again. It's Mitchell Warren from AVAC, and delighted to welcome you to this webinar, another in our year-long series on prevention on the line. And if you are on the web right now, you will see in the introductory slide the URL for the archive, avac.org/prevention-on-the-line-webinars, where you can access past recordings and slides from the calls that we've done so far in the series. And after this call is completed, the recording and the slides will also go up. So please do feel free to go through the whole series. This call is an exciting one for all of us. It's about new frontiers in research around not only HIV prevention, but also treatment and cure, looking at one of the newer areas of research that really coming into the fore and beginning to have publications and clinical trials being designed and implemented around the world. And we really thought it was important to present this in early in 2015 around prevention on the line. I'm delighted to have a number of people on the line to help address various issues related to prevention on the line and antibody and passive immunization-based research. Just some logistics for the day. The call right now is in a global mute to keep the line nice and clear for recording, but we want people to engage with questions throughout. If you are on the ReadyTalk web chat, you can, in the chat feature, put your questions in at any point, and we will be putting them in the queue to raise later in the call. You can also email avac@avac.org at any point in the call, and we'll put those questions in. And after conversations and presentations over the next little while, we'll open up the lines and you'll be able to hit *7 to unmute your line and *6 again to mute it, and I'll go through those instructions later on, just so people are aware of the process. One of the presenters, Sarah Schlesinger, who is from the Rockefeller University in New York and has been involved in one of the most recent studies that was published around antibody-based research, is unfortunately only able to join us in about 20 minutes or so. And so we are going to shift the order of the call a bit today. I'm going to very briefly present a few slides from our PX Wire publication that came out just yesterday that looks at the pipelines related to antibodies, long-acting antiretroviral injectable prevention, and preventive vaccines. And just to give you a bit of a orientation to some of the key issues and where antibodies might fit. And then Richard Jeffries from the Treatment Action Group, who wrote a terrific piece a couple of weeks ago in TAG's newsletter, looking at where we are with vaccine, antibody, and cure research, is going to talk briefly about antibody research. And then we'll take a few questions, and then hopefully by that point Sarah will join us and take us through the rest of her slides. So that's kind of the order for the day. Richard, I think you're on, but if you do want to hit *7 in just a minute or two, and I'll turn it over to you in just a second. But as I said, and just to get started and provide a bit of context, we put out every quarter PX Wire, a quarterly update on prevention research. If you didn't get it in your inbox yesterday or this morning, please feel free to email avac@avac.org or go on to the web, the AVAC website, avac.org/PXWire, and you'll be able to download the issue, but also sign up for future issues. But this issue had the center spread related to the pipeline of various new research approaches. And we thought it might be useful just to go through in a couple of minutes what we had in that center spread. I've taken the pieces of it to make it a little bit more legible on the slides. But as we described in the original AVAC report, Prevention on the Line, that came out in February, and again in more detail in the PX Wire issue, we wanted to explore the three areas and provide a bit of a very brief summary of what is in each of these areas of research. And so in this larger pipeline, you'll see three categories. And there's antibodies, long-acting injectable antiretrovirals, which you'll see in a minute in orange, and then preventive vaccines in blue. And I do want to make clear that these are this is a selection of the pipeline. There's a lot of activity in each of these three areas. What we tried to do in the graphic and in these slides is simply to provide a bit of an overview with a selected list of what was in each of these categories. So you'll see in each of them, we tried to describe very briefly what is the strategy, what might it do, and some key facts, and then I'll show you in a moment just what that pipeline looks like. So you can see on the slide now that the antibody space, the idea around, you'll hear both Richard and Sarah describe it, a term you'll hear more and more, passive immunization, the idea that delivering antibodies that are delivered in one of two ways. One might be actually infusing people with the antibody, and the other, as you'll see on the second bullet, using different vectors or genes to deliver the antibody. And again, both Richard and Sarah will describe a bit of that. What's interesting in this antibody research is that it's being explored not just for prevention and the idea that these antibodies might actually prevent an infection, but also being explored for both potential therapeutic and cure or eradication strategies. And again, you'll hear more about that from Sarah and from Richard. What is interesting is that in the next slide, you'll see this rather selected pipeline, and there are many, many more antibodies that have been discovered just in the last 6 years or so, and Richard will describe a bit about that. These are a set of antibodies that are kind of at the front of the queue in terms of what's being studied. And the very first one, and these are listed in alphabetical order, but the first one, 3BNC117, is the antibody that Sarah Schlesinger's team at Rockefeller has been working on and just published, and you'll hear a bit about that. The second one, the AAV vector, is the antibodies, the PG9, and every one of these antibodies has a code name, and again, they come from different research groups, which Richard will describe, but the AAV vector is used in this set of studies to deliver the antibody, whereas some of these other studies are actually infusing the antibody. And again, you can see some others that are described in the table, and they target different parts of the virus, and again, Sarah's going to describe some of that. The negative and positive symbols in this slide show you some of these antibodies are being explored for both prevention amongst HIV-negative individuals, and some are being explored also in as therapy for HIV-positive individuals. And you can see on the far right-hand side where some of these trials are taking place. The next set in orange, just to orient everybody, are a range of long-acting injectable antiretrovirals. And certainly with ARVs, people are much more aware of them than perhaps with antibodies because so many ARVs are in use in therapeutic programs. And of course, we have oral PrEP using the combination tenofovir emtricitabine as Truvada, which is actually approved in the United States and being explored in projects all over the world around oral PrEP. This body of work, though, is looking at antiretrovirals that could be potentially formulated as injectables. And not every antiretroviral, as you'll see in some of the key facts on the far right, not every antiretroviral can be formulated as an injectable dose. But a couple of them have been already formulated that way and are being studied. These would be given on a periodic basis. For prevention, the studies are looking at one of the injectables every 2 months and one of the injectables every 3 months. And you can see that the combination of two of these are actually being explored as a therapeutic regimen with different dosing every 4 or 8 weeks. Some people think that this could address significant adherence issues that we have with pill taking, whether for treatment or for prevention, and that might surely be true. But of course, getting back to the clinic every 2 or 3 months has a different kind of adherence requirement. So it won't address all issues, but it is certainly one of the hot topics in the research arena. And here you can see two of the leading long-acting injectables. Both are being explored separately in phase 2 studies. You can see GSK744 and TMC278. And then the combination of those two products is being explored in a therapeutic trial. And as I think many of you may know, AVAC did a webinar last year around the pipeline of long-acting antiretrovirals, and those materials and archives are available on the website. But we did just want to give that perspective, a very different kind of injection, but an important one for people to be aware of as we think about future prevention. And then finally, the third area in this infographic from the PXWire issue around preventive vaccines, and again, this has been something that has been part of the AIDS response in terms of the importance of research and discovery of an AIDS vaccine since as soon as the virus was identified. We have the one very positive result from a human clinical trial, the so-called RV144, which has triggered a number of activities, which I'll show you on the next slide, but certainly not the only activity in the vaccine landscape. And you'll hear also from both Richard and Sarah the relationship between the antibody research and vaccine research, because we would hope that a vaccine could be developed that might generate some of the antibodies that were in the purple slides earlier on. But there's obviously a robust pipeline of AIDS vaccines. This is just one very brief snapshot. There are many, many vaccine candidates in studies, but the ones that the bottom three rows, ALVAC, that was, of course, part of the RV144 regimen that has so much excitement attached to it, follow-on research happening in South and Southern Africa as well as in Thailand, as depicted in those three rows. The very top row here, though, in under preventive vaccines, relates to a different strategy altogether using the Adeno 26 vector, a different vector entirely, and studies are beginning in the United States, in Africa, and in Thailand, and that's on a development track as well. There are many other things, as I say, and the AVAC website can point you to the direction of the pipeline. I also doubt, given that we're in April already, that just next month, May 18th, of course, is HIV Vaccine Awareness Day, and we will be doing a webinar in the Prevention on the Line series focused specifically around AIDS vaccines. So we're not going to go into too much detail about that on this call. So that's just a very, very brief snapshot related to the three domains of different approaches to prevention in kind of the injectable space, vaccines, ARVs and antibodies. I want to turn it over then to Richard Jeffries from the Treatment Action Group, who's one of the great science writers for lay audiences, to help describe a bit about antibodies, where they've come from, and why they are such the important conversation right now. So Richard, if you can, it's *7 to unmute your line. Richard? You just pause for a moment. I think we were having some trouble hearing Richard. I think we're going to try calling out to him. Maybe what I'll do just for the moment then is take any quick questions from what I've presented here. Not that I will answer or could answer them, but at least to get questions in the queue for both Richard and then when Sarah joins. So any questions? Again, you can hit *7 to unmute your line. Well, there's actually a great question in the chat feature that I might take from a great colleague in Europe about the nasal administration. And many of you may know we think of vaccines as products that are injected because most often that is the case. There is actually one of the flu vaccines that's in use is administered through a nasal spray, and there has been work trying to develop AIDS vaccines using a nasal administration that is very attractive for people who might not want to get an injection once or multiple times. There is not right now any easily administered vaccine or antibody that I'm aware of that is in human clinical trials, but it is certainly something that is in a lot of the discovery phases because that would certainly be an optimal delivery mechanism. But none of the products that we'll be talking about here in either the vaccine or the antibody approach are yet able to be administered in that way. And another question, and a great one just to clarify from Charles, May 18th itself is HIV Vaccine Awareness Day, and we will be sending out a notice shortly, but we are planning to do a webinar on that day, May 18th, which is a Monday, as part of Vaccine Awareness Day, that will be an overview of the HIV vaccine landscape. So stay tuned for that call, and again, the next one of them in this call series. Great. And Richard, are you on the line? Okay, I think we're going to try a different number to call him out. And I should say, as all of these webinars, they will be available, the materials, the recording, and the slides that we've just presented here, as well as the recording of the call, will be available on the AVAC website, and you'll see on the home screen a clear link to the Prevention on the Line webinar series, and that will have all the past calls as well as the slides on this call. I should also say that the PXWire issue that we published yesterday included the slides I've shown so far as kind of a single infographic is available on the web at avac.org/pxwire, as well as the article that's on the outer pages of the issue relate to both conversations about antibody research as well as an update on oral PrEP and some of the very recent important momentum on translating clinical trial data in oral PrEP into public health impact as we all look to how PrEP can and should be added to combination prevention and treatment programs. So that issue of PXWire is available. And Richard, are you there now?
Hi, Mitchell. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can, Richard, loudly and clearly. Wonderful. So maybe I'll turn it over to you, and I know a question that comes up so often is, well, where did all these antibodies come from that everyone's talking about? And I wonder if you might give a little bit of a primer to why we're talking about all of this and how we got to this place.
Sure thing. I think, you know, there has been some confusion around this issue of sort of where these antibodies have come from, and I think there's studies done in thousands of people, none of them on treatment. The basic criteria were that they were over 18 and had HIV infection for over 3 years, and really the breakthrough was the availability of new technology that allows really detailed studies of B cells in these people, which are the antibody-making factories. And the way the technology is now, actually sort of tens of thousands of different B cells from an infected individual can be analyzed to see what type of antibody they're making and how well that antibody is capable of inhibiting HIV infection. So out of several thousand people, there's maybe 1% who make some antibodies that are incredibly potent in their ability to inhibit HIV and can inhibit HIV from a number of different strains from around the globe. And so those are of what have become known as the broadly neutralizing antibodies. Unfortunately, although some of them have come from people that have slow disease progression most just come from people. They don't seem to have affected progression very much in the people they've been isolated from. And it's really probably just a numbers game in that the B cell, although it's making a good antibody, it's kind of overwhelmed because there's so much virus present, and it's among a bunch of B cells that are making less effective antibodies. And so it's churning out a small amount of an antibody that isn't really able to lower the viral load in the individual that's making that antibody. But when you take it out and sort of look at it in detail and infuse it in greater numbers, then it can have activity. So that's a kind of important thing to know about where these antibodies are coming from. They don't seem to be providing much benefit in the natural setting, but they can be exploited when they're isolated on their own and manufactured. And it's really these new techniques that allow so many B cells to be looked at that have allowed these to be found, but it takes a lot of work. And I think, you know, the other thing that's maybe worth knowing in the context of the call today is obviously, you know, we know that antibodies can protect against a number of infections. So there's been interest in looking for effective antibodies against HIV for prevention. But in the treatment realm, it's a fairly new thing. And it's partly about the fact that in addition to just blocking HIV infection, antibodies can sort of recruit other immune cells to deal with HIV-infected cells. There's a mechanism called antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity. And basically what happens is that a cell infected with HIV sometimes sort of expresses some part of the HIV on the outside of the cell as like a warning sign that it's infected. And a broadly neutralizing antibody can bind to that part of HIV that's on the outside of the infected cell, and that flags the infected cell for destruction by natural killer cells or monocytes or other immune system cells. And so there's some evidence from animal studies that these antibodies can not only inhibit HIV replication, but promote the clearance of infected cells. And that could be very important from the perspective of cure research.
Great. Thank you so much, Richard. I wonder, again, Sarah's going to join us in just a couple of minutes, but I wonder if people have some questions for Richard and about kind of the basic background to antibodies. Actually, one came in, Richard. I mean, interesting perspective and wonder what your take is. Around the ethics and about whether those HIV-infected individuals who are the source of the antibodies, if they're compensated in any way or acknowledged or aware of the value of their contribution. Do you know?
I don't know what the actual protocol was for the sampling. You know, it's described in some of the studies that have been published. It's possible that there was some compensation for time, but I don't know that for sure. I would hope that there's some education has been done around why the studies were being done, but I'm not sure. I think there's been various teams doing these studies, but one of the largest efforts was undertaken by the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. And they tend to set a pretty high bar in terms of the ethics of what they're doing. So I think there would have been some dialogue around those issues.
Great, and we'll certainly follow up on that. The question came from Charles Gonzalez, and I think it's a really important one. I will also say I was just last week, and I put up the slide here of the list of antibodies, but you'll see the third one down, CAP-256, and the CAP stands for Caprisa, you know, the team led by Croatia and Slim Abdul Karim in South Africa. And CAP-256 is actually the participant number of someone who was in their acute infection study who has been very involved and kept informed now for over 5 years since that antibody was first discovered through the sampling and very much part of the Caprisa family. And I know that at least in that instance, her engagement with the research team has been quite longstanding and important. Richard, another great question did come in about, you know, recently because of and you'll hear from Sarah about the studies with directly delivering antibodies, but a question came in from a wonderful colleague about what's the prospect of an antibody-inducing vaccine? You know, originally the idea was, I think, that these antibodies would help direct vaccine discovery, and I'm curious your sense of expectations about what a vaccine prospect would be to induce these antibodies as opposed to simply infusing it directly.
Sure. I think, you know, there's a number of perspectives you can take, including the sort of traditional glass half full or half empty approach. I think that the upside of the discovery of these antibodies is that really it shows that the human immune system is capable of making effective antibodies against HIV. And for a long time, it wasn't really clear if that was a possibility, because the virus has so many sort of decoy targets on its envelope. There's a lot of bad, sort of not very effective antibodies that get made. So it wasn't clear if it was actually possible for a human B cell to make a good antibody. And we now know for sure that they can. So that's the good news. The not so good news is that clearly these antibodies are coming from people whose immune systems have been exposed to a lot of HIV. They've been infected for at least 3 years. There's been a lot of, they have a lot of sort of HIV variants that have been generated over that time. And those many HIV variants are sort of driving the immune response over this very long period, to make sort of increasingly, or at least some of the B cells, is driving them to make these increasingly effective antibodies. It involves a lot of what they call maturation of the B cell response, a lot of genetic sort of shuffling of the genetic code that eventually produces better and better antibodies. And because it seems to take so long and it's quite rare in natural infection, it suggests that it could be quite challenging to try and recapitulate that process with a vaccine, but hopefully not impossible. And certainly there's a lot of effort now being put in to seeing how you might mimic the processes involved in generating these antibodies in infected people with a vaccine, including sequential immunizations, the development of specific sort of immunogens, the component of the vaccine that's designed to elicit the anti-HIV immune response, being specifically designed to sort of have a starting one, follow-up, all kind of structurally designed to try and mimic the process that happens in natural infection. And that may be a possibility. And there are also some sort of other work where they may be able to make versions of the HIV envelope that are much more like those that are able to generate these kinds of responses. And so there's progress on those fronts, but as yet, you know, we have yet to see anyone generating an antibody like this with a vaccine. And we can only hope that one day that will happen.
Great. Thank you so much, Richard. Sarah, I think perhaps you have joined. Sarah, are you on? If you want to hit star 7, unmute yourself. All right. I think we will still wait a moment for Sarah to be sure she's on and unmuted. Richard, a question that I don't know if you can answer, but also from Charles. Can you describe the difficulties, and perhaps also some of the specific definitions of the words, difficulties involved with the glycosylation and the immune system surveillance?
I will give it a go. I'm not sure that I fully understand the question. My understanding of glycosylation in the context of HIV is it tends to refer to the fact that the HIV envelope is a glycose, basically sugar, I think, and the HIV envelope, one of the ways that it avoids antibodies is by being covered in a lot of sort of decoy sugar molecules, and this makes it very hard for antibodies to block the vulnerable parts of the virus. And so one of the reasons that these antibodies seem to take a long time to arise is that they have to be some pretty weird kind of shapes in order to get past these sugar molecules and block the part of the virus that really matters when it's infecting a cell. But antibodies themselves can also be glycosylated. They can have sugary parts to them too. And so one of the criteria for antibody effectiveness can relate to how the sort of structural makeup of the antibody, and there's a lot of work going on. Probably the best known person working on it is a fantastic researcher named Galit Alter, who is doing this incredible work looking at all the factors that might make an antibody effective against HIV, including how glycosylated the antibody is and other features that might make it good, particularly good at recruiting antibody-mediated cellular cytotoxicity and things like that. And so there's kind of glycosylation on both the virus and then the antibody side going on. But that's as far as I can go on that.
That's a great answer, Richard. And one other that did just come in real quickly, and then we'll turn it over to Sarah, who I believe is actually on, do you want to just quickly, I know Sarah's going to spend time talking about the direct delivery of antibodies. You, in your piece a couple weeks ago, described the vector-based approach to passive immunization. Do you want to just give the quick differentiation between those two approaches?
Sure. So there's a lot of interest in this. It's almost like a kind of gene therapy, really. It's a virus vector. It's an adeno-associated virus, it's called. It just acts as a little bit of genetic code that can go into a muscle tissue and make an antibody or any protein that you sort of insert in the genetic code. It'll churn out that protein in the muscle tissue for years and years. And adeno-associated virus, or AAV, is used in all kinds of studies for that reason. It's being used as a way to try and deliver the clotting factor for hemophiliacs, for example, and has shown some promise there. And so the interest is maybe you can put in the genetic code for these antibodies into the AAV and have the AAV will take that code into the muscle tissue, and that'll become a little factory for making these antibodies in a person for many years, or maybe even for life. And there's a phase one study that you mentioned at the beginning that's going on in the UK, looking at that possibility, and there's interest in doing more studies. I think there's some of the key issues are whether they can make a high enough level of the antibody for it to be protective or to be effective as a therapy. Also, whether the immune system might block the action of the AAV by responding to the AAV. And some safety issues. They would like to have some sort of way of being able to turn off the antibody production by the AAV. And they're looking at all, sort of having an off switch just in case there was a safety concern. But that is because it might be something that could be done with one injection, it is an alternative that's being looked at very intensely.
Great. Richard, thank you so much. That was terrific and a perfect foundation for our next presenter. So I believe Sarah is on. Sarah, if you hit *7, you will be unmuted. Sarah here you are, a fabulous clinician, friend, I should also say a member of the AVAC board, based at Rockefeller University, and is part of the team that published, I guess now 2 weeks ago, in the journal Nature, the initial results of the first in human study with this particular monoclonal antibody. And we thought it would be great to have Sarah provide both the context for the research, but also the experience with this particular antibody. So I will turn it over to you, Sarah, and we will advance your slides as you go.
Okay, so that's the one question that I have, Mitch, is I have a call, a number, so I'm on audio, but I don't have any video in front of me. I have my own slides.
No problem. If you say next slide, we will advance them for you. Fear not.
Okay, but I can't see what slide we're up to is the problem.
Oh, okay. Well, right now I have you on the intro slide.
Okay, that says New Frontiers in
Yes.
HIV Prevention, Treatment, and Cure. So the development of this new antibody, and first of all, thank you, Mitch. As Mitch said, I am a physician scientist here at the Rockefeller. I like to think of myself as an advocate. I've been on the AVEC board for some number of years now. And in the last, 5 years, I've been working with Michelle Nussenzweig on the development of 3BNC117. Clearly, we don't have marketing people yet for the name. It's not very catchy. But that is the monoclonal antibody that we started with. So next slide, please. So as we all know, there are many challenges associated with HIV treatment and prevention. ART is very effective but cannot eradicate HIV infection. And despite substantial increases in coverage, only 38% and 24% of children in need are currently receiving ART. And those are huge advances over where we were, but clearly it's not enough. New infection rates remain higher than we would like, 2.1 million in 2013. Engagement with HIV care remains a challenge. Less than 25% of HIV-positive people are suppressed in this country, and it's lower than that abroad. An effective vaccine is clearly an important part of the prevention toolbox, perhaps the most important part, but it's not going to be available. Results from late-phase efficacy studies won't be available till 2020. So a major challenge to an effective vaccine is the rapid establishment of a viral reservoir. Vaccines that block infection, you have to work very early to actually prevent the establishment of that reservoir. Next slide. So with leaving a vaccine as sort of the holy grail, what are some of the other approaches that we can use for biologic prevention? So I just want to go backwards a little bit to the immune system. And the immune system, if you recall, has two kinds of lymphocytes, T lymphocytes, which directly kill, and B lymphocytes, and the slide should say B lymphocytes, which are the antibody-producing cells. So they produce immunoglobulin, which is the same as antibody. Antibody is a lay term for immunoglobulin, in response to antigen. And in this case, our antigen is HIV. So antibody that is produced by B cells has this Y-shaped configuration that you see here. I should have said next slide. Do you all see the Y-shaped configuration? And this is produced by B cells. It may be neutralizing, which means it kills the virus, or non-neutralizing. And in fact, when non-neutralizing antibodies can be very important as well. The Y-shaped end is called the antibody binding region. And the constant region, or the back, is called the FC, or the constant region. And I heard Richard, as I got on, talk about glycosylation. And people think about the glycosylation and frankly, the effects of the FAB region. But new research from a colleague of mine named Jeff Ravitch here at the Rockefeller is defining how both glycosylation and fucosylation, which is another sugar, of the constant region or the FC region affect how antibodies work. And in fact, with this 3BNC117, we've demonstrated that the FC region actually has an important role to play. So these antibodies are made in the blood all the time by people who are infected with HIV. So the next slide, please. So antibodies, preformed antibodies made either in a person or in an animal, have been used to treat infectious diseases since the turn of the last century. So here you see a slide that has passive immunization, and passive immunization is the term used for the infusion of a preformed antibody, and it's effective against many infectious diseases and licensed, in fact. So you can see here the list of diseases for which it is in current use. Hepatitis B is sort of the one I think that people know best. In addition, just from historical interest, before there were antibiotics, the very best treatment for pneumonia was a preformed antibody that was raised in a horse or horse serum. Some of you may have heard of that. So this is a methodology that's quite, you know, has a long history and has been used quite safely. So if we move to the next slide, we see a beautiful picture here that looks almost like a flower. And this is the glycosylation pattern that Richard was describing of HIV. And over time, people who are infected with HIV develop antibodies. They develop a robust immune response. And in fact, the first step of the test for HIV is in fact a test for antibody, not for anything else. And the antibodies that people generate can be to all different places on the HIV envelope, which is what we see here. Michelle Nussenzweig, my colleague and colleagues in the lab, developed a methodology for picking out the very most potent antibodies. So over 2 or 3 years, most people who are infected will develop neutralizing antibodies. The problem is the virus is so smart that it mutates away from those antibodies. But those antibodies are still neutralizing for other viruses that are out there. So Michelle and colleagues isolated these antibodies and pulled out the most potently neutralizing ones. And so 3BNC is among the most potent neutralizing antibodies. If you go to the next slide, please. So there have been many other antibodies that have been tested in humans against HIV, and that's what you see here. There's a whole choice. There's what was called HIVIG up at the top that was a polyclonal, so it was not a monoclonal antibody, but it was basically a whole bunch of antibody that had been collected from people who were HIV positive, purified in a way that removed all of the virus, and then it was given back particularly to pregnant women and infants. It was used to prevent transmission before antiretroviral drugs had been invented. Subsequent to that, there were a few highly neutralizing monoclonal antibodies, and you see them listed here. None of them worked well enough to really affect viral load. The bottom one that you see here, VRC01, is an antibody similar to 3BNC117 that was developed by the Vaccine Research Center, and it is currently in human clinical trials. So, next slide, please. Here you see the neutralization breadth, or these new antibodies that have been isolated by this new methodology effectively control HIV infection. And here you see the blue antibodies, 2G12, B12, 2F5, and 4E10, are some of the antibodies that were tested on the previous slide. 3BNC117, VRC01, and PGT121 and 10-1074 are antibodies that have been isolated by this newer methodology, and you can see that they are several logs more potent. You can also see 3BNC117, which is the red line, is considerably more potent than VRC01. PGT121 and 10-1074 are newer antibodies directed at a different part of the virus that are moving into the clinic shortly. So this next slide, please, is preclinical work, and in the interest of time, I'm not going to spend much time on it, but what it shows is a combination of 5 neutralizing antibodies suppresses HIV viremia in a humanized mouse. As you probably remember, mice can't be infected with HIV. Their cells don't have the proper receptors. So colleagues of ours have developed mice that have human cells that have the proper receptors. Now, this is not a perfect model by any means. I like to think of it as a furry test tube, but it is a furry test tube, and it shows that there is some promise for these antibodies. The next slide shows the effect of the antibodies, the antiviral effect, both in humanized mice and in SHIV-infected non-human primates. Again, both not perfect models, but what we have. So the next slide should have a mouse, a little monkey, and then a person. 3BNC can effectively suppress HIV viremia in humanized mice, but there's rapid escape. 3BNC can rapidly decrease viremia in non-human primates and in most cases maintain suppression until the antibody disappears from the blood or decays. And similar results were obtained with PGT-121 and 10-1074 by Dan Baruch and Xinghai et al. And these were published in Nature 2 years ago. So, the clinical investigation of 3BNC-117, we have a human monoclonal antibody. It's purely human. You can see the next slide. You can see the cartoon of it here. It targets the CD4 binding site on the HIV envelope. It is a human monoclonal of the IgG1 kappa class. The IC80 on combined group of 95 tier 2 viruses is 1.4 micrograms per mil. This means a very small amount of antibody kills almost all viruses. 5 mg per kilogram was effective in protecting animals against an intravectoral challenge in non-human primate studies. And 10 mg per kilogram induced rapid decline in plasma viremia in both the humanized mice and the non-human primates. So with this, we got money for manufacturing, we manufactured, we did all the preclinical work that has to go into an IND, we followed an IND. Next slide. The potential clinical applications of 3BNC and the other antibodies are in prevention in high-risk individuals if the PK profile, so if it stays around for a long time, in sufficiently long time in the blood. And this is particularly likely to be useful if the antibodies can be formulated for subcutaneous administration. Excuse me just one second. In HIV-infected individuals, these antibodies can be used as adjunct to conventional ART in intensification regimens and perhaps during ART interruptions. And most interestingly, they might be part of the cure agenda in eradication strategies. So here, the next slide, we see 3BNC-117 from the lab to clinic in the first-in-man study. So I'm not going to go over all of these. So each one of these little markers on this was a tremendous amount of work. It all got done. And we got approval from the Rockefeller IRB and an okay to proceed letter from the FDA. And the first infusion of 3BNC was February 12, 2014. So a little bit more than a year ago. Next slide, please. You can see here our vial for clinical use. This picture actually represents the culmination of a whole lot of work, but as you can see that the material was manufactured using good manufacturing processes and vialed accordingly, and is up to all the standards that any drug that would be used in this country is up to. Next slide. So the primary objectives of this study, and we call it, again, another catchy title, MCA-0835, and the MCA is for Marina Kasky, the physician who is the PI on these studies, and 0835 is simply the next study here done at the Rockefeller. So the primary study objectives, as for most first-in-human studies, are safety, tolerability, and PK, which means how fast does the drug stay around in the blood and how fast does it decay. Of a single intravenous infusion of 3BNC-117 in HIV-infected and uninfected individuals. Our second study objective was to see the effect on the plasma HIV RNA levels in those individuals who are HIV-infected and the frequency and magnitude of antibodies that would be induced to the 3BNC-117. Exploratory studies associated, frankly, which I'm not going to go into, are the genotyping of escape variants that might arise. Cell-associated HIV RNA, DNA levels, 3BNC-117 levels in genital secretions, and then again the HIV-1 specific T and B-cell immune responses following the administration. The hope is that this antibody might, by aggregating with the virus, form an antigen that would actually induce immunity, like an auto-vaccination. Next slide, please. So you can see here the first-in-man study of the 3BNC study groups, the HIV negative and the HIV positive. These groups proceeded in parallel, again, because we are looking at this as both potentially as a prophylactic for people who are HIV negative and a therapeutic for people who are already HIV positive. As is the case with almost all first-in-human studies, we started at a very, very low dose, and as each dose was safe, we then escalated to the next dose. So you can see here that we had two individuals who received 10 mgs per kg, five individuals who received 10 mgs per kg, and three of five individuals who received 30 additional doses, I'm sorry, additional groups that received two doses of 10 mgs per kg and 32 doses of 30 mgs per kg as well. In the HIV infected, there are additional groups, as you can see, received 10 mgs per kg on ART, 30 mgs per kg off ART, and those were people who had a viral load of less than 2,000, 30 mgs per kg on ART with a viral load of greater than 20, and then 30 mgs per kg on ART with a viral load of 1 to 20. So those are people who are not fully suppressed, but below the level of detection of the conventional assay. The next slide, please, just shows you the study design. We can do this very quickly. We screened the people. They came in, again, for another screening visit. They got an infusion of one infusion of 3BNC117, and that was given IV over an hour, and then we followed them at the intervals noted. The next slide, please, shows the 3BNC study enrollment and safety. 45 subjects were enrolled, 15 completed follow-up to date, 29 HIV infected, 16 off ART, and 13 on ART. Baseline HIV viral load in subjects off ART was 640 to 53,000, so there was a big range of copies per mil. Safety for subjects receiving 1, 3, 10, and 30 mgs per kg. Again, we started at 1, which is a very low dose. No serious adverse events. It was well tolerated. Most reported adverse events were graded as mild. Transient fatigue and headache were the two that stood out. Next slide shows the pharmacokinetics of the 3BNC infusion. So the half-life is in HIV infected was 9.6 days, and in uninfected 17.6 days. That's not unexpected because the people who are HIV infected have the virus that acts as an antigen and binds the antibody. The Cmax was 669.8. That's the maximum concentration in the HIV infected, and 495.9, and you can see there's a fairly significant range presented below. So this is favorable pharmacokinetics for an antibody like this. It's hanging around, which is good. Summary, safety and PK, next slide. 3BNC117 has been generally safe and well-tolerated. Doses up to 30 mgs per kg in HIV uninfected and HIV infected individuals on and off ART. Its half-life is approximately 2.5 weeks in HIV uninfected individuals, and viremic HIV infected individuals, it's slightly shorter. So now comes the punchline. Does it have an effect on is there antiviral activity? You obviously all know since I'm here and it was in Nature that there is, but at 1 mg per kg, which we started, which I think you can see here on the next slide, there's very little, if really no antiviral activity. At 3 mg per kg, you see a little bit of a dip, and then it comes right back up. At 10 mgs per kg, you actually start to see an effect, and in some individuals there was a significant effect. And in 30 mgs per kg, there is an effect, a dose effect, that is significant, not in all individuals, but you can see it here. And each one of those blue lines represents one person, and the red line is the summation. So summary of the virologic effects, a single administration of 1 or 3 mgs per kg of 3BNC led to a small effect on plasma viremia, we did see emergence of resistance. Due to time, I didn't show you all of the resistance data, but I can provide that additionally if others are interested. a single administration of 30 mg per kg led to a decline in plasma viremia in all individuals treated up to 2.5 logs with an average of 1.48 logs. So about 1.5 logs is the average reduction in viremia with this antibody. Plasma viremias remain significantly reduced for 28 days, a whole month. Decline in viremia correlated with baseline sensitivity to 3BNC117 and starting viral load. So in those individuals who were not sensitive to 3BNC17, where we, particularly in the 10 mg per kg group, there's one individual where there's no drop. She was resistant before. We didn't know it when we administered it to her, but we tested the sample subsequently. 3BNC117 selected resistant viral strains in some but not all viremic individuals treated, and the long-term effects on viremia and on host immune response remain to be determined. And stay tuned because we're working on that, and I'll be happy to follow up. So future studies, we're going to evaluate the effects of 3BNC117 on host immune responses, and we're going to evaluate if 3BNC alters levels of circulating HIV RNA and cell-associated HIV RNA and DNA. Future clinical studies, can 3BNC prevent virologic rebound when ART is discontinued? Can 3BNC affect the size of the reservoir or alone in combination with latency-reversing agents? That's romidepsin. And will 3BNC-117 in combination with 1074 lead to more significant effects on viremia? So, next slide. In summary, 3BNC-117 is safe, has a favorable pharmacokinetics, and has a effect on viremia of a 1.48, reduction of 1.48 logs on average. This slide, the last slide, the second to last slide here, you see a statue. We're here in New York City on 66th and York. This is 67th and Central Park, and this is Balto. And I don't know how many of you know who Balto is, but as far as I'm concerned, he is the mascot of all antibody therapy because he is the dog who led the dog sled that carried diphtheria antitoxin, which is diphtheria antibody, from Anchorage to Nome to save the children of Nome. And his trek is now the route of the Iditarod dog sled race. But he was it was antibody that was in his pack that he was carrying to save the children of Nome. And the next last slide has the inscription on the statue, which I think is inspiring. And it's dedicated to the indomitable spirit of the sled dogs that relayed antitoxin 600 miles over treacherous waters through Arctic blizzard to rescue stricken Nome in the winter of 1935. Endurance, fidelity, and intelligence. And endurance, fidelity, and intelligence seems like a pretty good motto to me. With that, next slide. These are the acknowledgments. Obviously, this work was done by many, many people. Michelle Nussenzweig heads the lab. He developed the technique by which these antibodies were isolated and has supervised all of us in all of this work. Marina Kasky, whose slide this is, so her name does not appear on this slide, is the physician who did all of the studies, led all of the studies with our clinical vaccine team. Celldex Therapeutics manufactured the antibody, and we had collaborators with both at the University of Cologne, clinical collaborators, and Weill Cornell Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital. And Mike Siemens at the Deaconess did all of our resistance testing. This was supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller University, and the HHMI. So with that, thank you very much. Next slide, and this is the team that did the work.
Fantastic. Sarah, thank you so, so much. For those of you who don't know Sarah, she's on the top back left when you're looking at the screen with glasses and a white blouse. But Sarah, thank you so very much. I realize we're just at the top of the hour, but happily many people are still on the line, which is terrific. We will happily take questions. Several have come in on the chat function. Keep them coming. You can also email avac@edec.org. Whatever we don't get to, we will certainly be following up with Sarah. And as I think I said at the very beginning, this call is being recorded, and the slides you've seen as well as the recording will be available. So if you do drop off for other things at the top of the hour, you can always come back on and listen to the Q&A. Let me start with a couple of questions, Sarah, that came in, and then maybe I'll open the line up and star 7 for people to unmute. The two questions actually related to numbers. One is just for those not in Europe or Africa. Obviously, everything is being denoted in the dosing by milligrams per kilogram. I was wondering what would a person of some weight in the U.S. pound, what would that look like? And before you answer that, a question about you clearly were doing dose escalation from up to 30, and a question came in from someone, why not look beyond 30? Was that seen, what was the threshold for 30 being the largest dose? So perhaps take those two to start.
Okay, well, let me take the second one first, and it's a completely practical reason. We would love to go to a higher dose. These antibodies are very safe. These are human antibodies, so people make these in their blood all the time, and they are both theoretically safe, and in practice, it was very safe. But in manufacturing, the highest dose that we were able to manufacture, because of the way the cell lines, so these are manufactured, so these are isolated from humans, they're then sequenced. The sequence is then synthetically made and reintroduced into a Chinese hamster ovary, or CHO cell line, which is an FDA-approved methodology of producing protein. And it's simply a matter of the amount of protein that could be produced and how concentrated it was. We couldn't, at the peak following the administration, 1/10 or 10% of the person's immunoglobulin was our antibody. So we didn't feel that we could go much higher than that. And how much is the dose? Was that the other question?
Yeah, for someone who's not working in the kilogram system. So if someone weighs, say, 150, 160 pounds, how big a dose would you be getting? Because you were saying it's milligrams per kilogram.
Right, so I'm just trying to think. You know what? I'm going to have to get back to you on that. I'd have to do the conversion.
Okay.
And it'll take me a couple of minutes. I can do it. And I'll
no problem. We will look at a Google conversion. And I guess a related question to dose two. How different are the different antibodies? So, you know, you talked about all of these antibodies, several of which are in studies, the VRC01, the PGT, you know, 121. Are all antibodies kind of in that 30 milligrams per kilogram range in terms of the manufacturability, or is each antibody quite different?
Well, the VRC01 has spent, so there's something called formulation work, and formulation work is, so you have the antibody, and how the antibody is dissolved in the what's called the excipient, which is the material in which it's dissolved, is an issue for how concentrated you can make it. So how concentrated you can make it in the solution in which it's going to be given, there are what they call tricks, and I'm not expert in this at all, but it involves the use of salts and sugars, you know, very basic kinds of chemistry things. And so the folks at the VRC have spent a fair amount of time and money on concentrating their antibody. So theirs is much more concentrated than ours. I believe ours is at 20 mg per mil. That's so you have 20 milligrams in a milliliter of antibody. And I believe that theirs is at 100 mg per mil.
Mm, okay.
But they've worked on that, and that represents an accomplishment for them. I don't know, the 10-1074 hasn't been manufactured. No, 10-1074 is ours, and so VRC01 and 3BNC117 are CD4 binding site antibodies. So they're similar in the part of the virus they target. They have their differences, but they are of a similar class, say. They're both in the clinic. 10-1074 is our next antibody, which will be entering the clinic in the next several months, and it is at a similar concentration to 3BNC117. It's in vials. I don't know about PG-121 yet. I don't believe it's sufficiently far along. If it is sufficiently far along, I don't know about it.
Okay, so that's great. And I actually, as you were talking, I put back up this slide that, as you very nicely described, looks kind of like the flower in terms of all the different sites and the various antibodies. And because the question came up in terms of when people think of antiretroviral therapy, of course, we now know as a standard, it would be combinations. And a question came up about what would we be looking both for prevention and for therapy at combination antibodies, and what's the basis, you know, if it's combined, would it be picking different antibodies that are looking at different sites?
Yes, that's the thinking, that the use of the antibodies would be analogous to the use of antiretroviral therapy, so that you probably need more, almost certainly for treatment, you need more than one. I think everybody agrees. And whether it's two or three or more, that I don't know. I think most people are thinking three, probably extending from the drugs. But each of them would presumably target a different part of the virus.
Great, thank you. And also just to clarify, and I think Richard addressed some of this, so, and again, looking at the flower slide and then each of these shapes with different areas where the antibodies go, is it true that almost all, if not all, of these antibodies that are noted here have been discovered all within the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, correct?
Yes. I think all within the last 5 years. I could go back and look. All of the new antibodies are, hold on 1 second. Let me go back to the slide, because I can look at the date of the paper, and I can tell you. I think it's even been shorter than that, Mitch.
Okay. So that's great, because I think the important point is this is such a new area, because there's so much we didn't know.
Right. This is a new technology, and this technology, it's a very interesting sort of intersection between an old technology and a new technology. So you have these old antisera, like the one that Balto carried, that were made in, frankly, they were made in horses. So there was no manufacturing. People injected microorganisms into a horse. They drew the blood, and then they isolated by what was called cone fractionation, the antibody portion. Then there was this newer technology that was used that actually was really pioneered by Herman Kattinger in the 90s, which resulted in these antibodies that are on this chart, so 2F5 to 2G12, 4E10. They were better, but they weren't good enough. Then the next group of antibodies would be the VRCO1, PG121, 1074, and the 3BNC 117, and that used this newer technology that was invented by Michelle Nussenzweig, and that involves cloning out individual B cells. So the individual B cells are sorted out. Remember at the beginning I showed you that antibodies are made by B cells. They are pulled out using a flow cytometric method, and then the antibodies are tested, and if they're desirable, they are then synthetically made using PCR in large quantity.
Great. That's and actually, that comment and answer relate to a question that just came in. Super exciting science, all these new discoveries. One issue that's come up already, I think, for a lot of people is it feasible and cost and also, is industry involved? Obviously, the Rockefeller team, amazing investigators and scientists. But what is there thinking about, is it feasible to produce and deliver this at scale, and is industry involved?
Right. So, Mitch, that is obviously the question that, you know, that haunts or all of us, that we think about all the time. And as I said when I got on the call, and you know very well, I'm an advocate. And, is this a very nice science experiment in humans, or does this really have opportunity to move forward? And I think that the answer is the latter. So it's going to be a lot of engineering to get it made at scale and to get it made at a reasonable cost. And what the thing on which it hinges, and it's not unlike the issue with a lot of vaccines, is the potency. So if these things are potent at a dose that can be delivered subcutaneously, if the – remember I said there's formulation work that makes them more concentrated, and that's what the VRC is really leading the way on that. If these can be made in such a way that they can be administered in a small enough volume subcutaneously at a reasonable cost, all of a sudden they are very useful. And there's going to be a lot of issues in rolling them out and a lot of issues in deployment because they do have to be administered using a needle. But the idea would be you could administer them, say, every ideally it would be every 6 months, but let's say every 3 months. The concentration at which they are now and the half-life, kind of every 3 months is what people are looking at. So you would get a subcutaneous injection every 3 months to prevent HIV. Now, obviously, that's not perfect. That's not a vaccine. I mean, people are hoping that maybe they could be stretched out to 6 months or even a year. I think that given current formulation, that's optimistic. The technology that Richard was talking about before I got on is another one that people are very excited about, and that's having these made sort of by a gene therapy technique. I have my concerns about that from a safety point of view, but that's, again, a separate discussion. So there are people, you know, we are all looking at how these can be moved forward to actually be useful both for treatment and prevention. There are companies that are involved. I believe that Gilead licensed, I don't want to say the wrong thing, I know that Gilead licensed one of them, not one of ours. I know that there are companies interested in ours, but we are at the moment not involved with any particular company. Other than Celldex Therapeutics, which is our partner in both manufacturing, and they do a lot of regulatory support for us, and they have a small interest in the antibodies.
Great, thank you. I don't know if it showed up, but I put a little marker on your slide. I believe Gilead has licensed at least therapeutic research for therapy for PGT21.
Right, that's what I thought too. I think that's
and others are also separately being in a prevention. So, but a really important space to watch. The one thing I would say as an advocate, we don't have lots of answers about cost and feasibility, but if you went back 20 years ago, if we didn't aggressively advocate for research to move apace with antiretrovirals because we weren't sure if they were affordable or feasible, we wouldn't now have almost 15 million people in antiretroviral therapy. So we want to be sure we don't not explore something because we think we know something that may change over time, but a really important issue to be managing and monitoring.
I must say that I can remember being in meetings where people were saying, you know, that antiretrovirals were never, ever going to be useful outside of the developing world because they were so complicated to take and they were so expensive and that it just wasn't feasible and to even work on it was a waste. And these were very high-level meetings. Mitch, you probably were at some of them as well. And obviously that was incorrect. So I think that we don't want to dismiss, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but clearly there are a lot of challenges in moving these forwards in ways that can be useful where they're most needed.
Absolutely. So maybe there are two additional questions that have come, but maybe I'll pause before I take them just to see anyone on the line. If you want to hit *7 to ask a question directly, I would ask that you introduce yourself. Any questions from the line? All right. Well, a question came in. You mentioned that at least one of the participants in the trial had resistance, and there was a question about we talk a lot about resistance with respect to antiretrovirals and drug resistance. Could you expand a bit on resistance within the context of these antibodies?
So, as I mentioned earlier, everybody who's HIV infected makes a robust antibody response. That's one of the hallmarks of HIV infection. As the antibodies are made in the person, the virus that's present become at first may be neutralized. It may have an effect. But over time, the virus is very smart, and it mutates to escape the antibody, and these are called escape mutations. And it forms an escape mutation, and then you have what's called a resistant mutant. and that resistant mutant has a survival advantage, and so it will divide the virus, and it will grow as a proportion of the amount of virus circulating in the person. So because these antibodies are not unique, if somebody who's HIV infected has by chance made an antibody similar to this, and then their virus has been exposed to it for a significant period of time, it may become resistant, or in some cases does become resistant. And then that resistant clone, as I said, expands sort of to fill the space. So that person, if you were to try to treat them or expose them to this antibody, their virus would already be resistant to it. So that's a problem. Most people are not resistant. How many people are going to be resistant to any of these is one of the things that we're going to have, that we are in the process of working out.
Great. That's super, super helpful, Sarah. And I know that a lot of people are happily still on the line. This issue of, this is exciting stuff, and you're terrific in explaining it. In the delivery of it to the individual, a question came up in terms of we think about an injection, but if you could just kind of describe what we're talking about in terms of what an individual participant is getting in terms of is it an IV bag like we think of intravenous, infusion? I mean, what's being delivered? And I guess a follow-on question to that is, and a lot of this has come up, of course, in the microbicide and PrEP world, the importance of working with potential product users early in the process. And there are obviously realities in terms of what an antibody can do and how to deliver it. But do you have a sense of the questions related to the users in terms of the potential desirability and acceptability of something like this?
See, so that is a very good question. Now, currently, what we're doing is not ever going to go forward. In terms of how it's administered, what we are doing is purely for test of concept, and that is people are getting, as you say, an IV bag. The antibody in the vial that I showed you, if you go back to the picture, you can see there's a picture of a vial, and then there's a picture of an IV bag behind it.
Going to it now, and there's the bag.
There's the bag. You see the little vial, and you see the IV bag. And so the vial, or actually several vials, because there's only, as I said, there's 20 mgs per mil of antibody, and there's only 1 mil in each vial. So several vials go, depending on the dose, go into the IV bag. They get mixed up. And then the person gets an IV, a small bore IV in their arm, and it's infused over an hour, 1 hour. The IV is then removed, and then they're watched for 4 hours by our nurses. Nothing has happened, but because this is a first-in-human test, we observe the people who received this for 4 hours. And that doesn't mean that somebody stands there and stares at them. It means that they have to hang around the clinic, and they get their vitals taken every 15 minutes for the first hour, and then every 30 minutes for the next hour, and I think every hour after that. I could be wrong. It could be every 30 minutes for 2 hours. I don't want to say the wrong thing, but it's something like that. Nobody would propose that methodology is going to be rolled out or deployed to any community. The reason it was done this way is because when the antibody is manufactured, this is the way that it is fastest to get it into the clinic. And as I mentioned, there is work that can be done, really engineering work, to change the formulation so it can both be more concentrated and can be compatible with being injected subcutaneously. That formulation work takes both time and money. And if the antibody wasn't going to have an effect, if it was, as a colleague of mine likes to say, dishwater, it wouldn't be worth it in our mind to put the time and money to formulating it for subcutaneous injection. Now that we've demonstrated that the antibody has antiviral effect, now we're starting to look at ways to address the formulation and make it compatible with subcutaneous injection. As I mentioned earlier, the VRC because they have different resources and a different kind of budget, made the decision to go ahead based on their preclinical data with formulating for subcutaneous administration and concentrating. So they're much farther along with that. But you're absolutely right. I think there's no question that as soon as it becomes, you know, this moves, I mean, this is still in the obviously science experiment stages, but we probably should already be thinking about how this is going to be rolled out. And it's not unlike the injectable antiretroviral drugs. You know, the way that it would be injected and the schedule is sort of similar to that. And I think it's reasonable to think of those tools in the prevention toolbox as being used in similar ways.
Great, Sarah, fantastic. You know, related to BRCA1, and I don't know if he's still on, but Steve Wakefield, I know, was on. Others, too, might be on from the HIV Vaccine Trials Network.
Right, and they're working with it, so they may be able to, you know, they may know more than I do.
Well, I was going to say, Steve, if you're on, I know that currently HVTN has a trial called HVTN 104, another elegant title and well-marketed, that is an early trial of VRCO1 in the United States that is looking at the VRCO1 antibody. With the idea that it could potentially, with positive signals from that, a future efficacy trial. Steve, are you on or anyone from the VTN who might know a bit about the dosing for VRCO1 in that trial? If you hit star 7 to unmute yourself.
I am on, but I'm
unable. Oh, wonderful.
I'm unable to speak to the dosing. Because one of the things that we're doing is looking at the problem Sarah just talked about, and that is what, if we're going to have a large number of people come in, how can we get a visit down to 60 or 90 minutes for an injection? And we actually have a couple of weeks of, we have a couple of teams that are out trying to figure out how we go about doing that and what we can learn from other infusion therapy practices. So, as with the question about kilograms, it would be something I could look up, but I don't have that off the top of my head.
Great. No problem, Wakefield. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but it's so helpful, and I think it's important. I think, and again, I'm going to put back up this slide from our PX Wire, and you can see the range of antibodies at very different places, from the 3BNC117 that Sarah described at the bottom of the table, the VRCO1 that the HVTN is working with, and a trial, I believe, for the future along in partnership with the HIV Prevention Trials Network, because, again, I think for those of us who work in vaccines and prevention, these antibodies really are a fascinating link between fields of both classic vaccine and broader prevention conversations. And then you can see some of the other antibodies on this table as well. Given all that Sarah described, and as Sarah, you so wonderfully described the early phase of trying to prove the concept with an eye always to what would we do next. This is obviously going to be the first of many conversations we all have as advocates, as researchers, as policymakers about what goes forward, how they're being studied, where they're being studied, and we count on more interactions with Sarah, you, and colleagues at Rockefeller, colleagues at the HVTN and HPTN, the Vaccine Research Center, the CAPRISA team working on the antibody. They've isolated lots of momentum and interest in this space, and obviously one that we will come back to many times over the years to come, I have no doubt. Thank you so much. So many people sticking on for the full 90 minutes. I want to particularly thank Richard Jeffries from TAG and Sarah, you from Rockefeller, and all of your colleagues in helping us take the next step in this next wave of exciting prevention and therapeutic and cure research that is so nicely described by you in the presentation. So, again, these slides from today and the recording will be available online shortly. There are more calls in the queue for Prevention on the Line, the annual series that we're doing. Past calls are listed on the website. Future calls, stay tuned. There is definitely one on May 18th, HIV Vaccine Awareness Day, focused on, surprise, surprise, HIV vaccines. And I just want to also say, so you said something that I don't think any of us can say often enough, in that these are all different areas of research to explore, none of which is, the answer, that ideally antibody and long-acting antiretrovirals and a vaccine, and the critical importance of rolling out oral PrEP to those who can and want to use it now, along with all sorts of other interventions, is the real main message across all of these calls, that Prevention on the Line is all of prevention, not any one intervention by itself. But thank you all so very much. If people do have additional questions, I know Sarah, I think I can speak for Sarah on this one, is the most accessible and approachable scientist you will meet. And if people have additional questions, we are happy to hook you up with Sarah and with Richard as well. And I know Wakefield would happily take questions at the HVTN. So thank you all very, very much. And we look forward to many more conversations.
Well, Mitch, thank you. And for those who stayed on the line, thank you for your time. And as Mitch said, any questions, please, Mitch, send them to you and you send them to me. Or if you even want to set up another hour at another time, I'm happy to, I'm happy to do that.
Fantastic, Sarah. Thank you so much. Have
thank
a great
you.
Afternoon, evening
Everybody.
For those of you. And for those still out west, enjoy the rest of your morning.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Cheers, all.